This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live your best life.
I can't stop the feeling. On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Live from Expo 2020 Dubai.
Hey there, this is Sonal standing in for Helen Farmer on Afternoons with Helen Farmer. On the podcast today, we're talking pets and vets. What do you need to know about getting your pets vaccinated? We've also got the story of a person who went through substance addiction. How he went through that and how he managed to get clean is on the way. And plus, we have got the Royal Air Force Red Arrows. They are putting on a show in Dubai, and we're getting the story about how it really all works up in the air. Afternoons with Helen Farmer is live from 2 to 5 p.m. every single weekday.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
Now, we're joined live on Microsoft Teams today by Dr. Martin Wyness, the founder and CEO of the British Veterinary Center. First of all, welcome, Dr. Martin. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sonal. Nice to be here.
And Zina is alongside me as well. She's promised to help me out a little bit with this segment because I have to admit, I don't have a pet. So we're relying on a lot of listener questions to come in today. I do know, though, that it's National Pet Wellness Month. And what can we do more of to ensure that pets are well looked after here?
Well, I hope most of the people that know me are probably looking after their pets pretty well by now, having had such stellar advice for many years. But the other people who don't know about pets so much it would benefit from more education, I think. I think a lot of the difficulties we see here are due to a lack of education, perhaps, about what pets are suitable, how they should be looked after and the like. So I would like to see the education ramped up. That would, in summary, if you want a quick answer.
Right. And I know one thing that you wanted to discuss as well is VaxiCheck. It's a test that monitors antibody levels in your pet's blood. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah. This is really interesting for us now because for many years, vets have been vaccinating everything against everything possible every year. And sometimes that is necessary for certain things. But we do suspect that a lot of the vaccines last longer than the one-year typical cycle. And there are some problems with just vaccinating against everything all the time. Firstly, if your pet's already immune, then there's no benefit in giving this vaccine. And in some cases, very, very small number of cases, you can have side effects. So why give something that might cause a problem if there's no benefit from giving it? The risk-reward, in other words, doesn't match up. So when we look at what manufacturers recommend, traditionally they've frequently recommended annual vaccines and we've had no choice but to go along with that. And sometimes also authorities recommend annual vaccines. More and more manufacturers are extending the time frame, so you might have a vaccine that lasts 2 or 3 years. But the point being is if you don't really know whether your pet's immune or not, you can't really make a sensible decision. So we can now just with a blood test check and see if your pet needs a vaccination or not. And it's just a more scientific way to go about things. The caveats are if you need to travel, you may have a different regime. It doesn't really work for rabies vaccines, which are recommended or actually we're discussing this, whether it's lawfully required in this country or just municipality rulings, it's often recommended that rabies vaccines are done regardless, and you will have to follow those rules. But for the core diseases, you know, distemper in dogs, for example, or panleukopenia in cats, we can test and see if you actually need that. So it's just being a bit more scientific in our approach, a very, very useful thing to be able to do. And it's a test that's just become available in the UAE in the last few months.
Oh, and brilliant. I think that's something a lot of pet owners are going to be thrilled to hear about because similar to the way humans don't necessarily want to take vaccinations that they don't have to or want to make sure they're effective about it, I guess the same applies to pets as well. Now, we've got a message in from Alyssa, and she's asking specifically about stray cats, which I know is something a lot of people in the community are concerned about. She's asked, is it illegal to feed stray animals in the UAE? How can we ensure strays can survive and have the right kind of sustenance? What's the responsible way to go about this? I think a lot of us have seen communities of strays. What is the right thing to do to help the whole situation, really.
Okay. In the absence of a coordinated government approach, in other words, one that goes across the whole country doing the right thing with an organization with the size and strength to do that, the next best thing that people can do with the cats is to look after them in the area where they find them. And the fact is that most cats will manage perfectly well out there if they are neutered and if they're fed. And the two things go together. If you're going to start feeding a little colony, or if you're going to feed a couple of cats to start with that might turn up on your doorstep, you'll very soon have a colony. And if you haven't done neutering, then this is getting out of control. You're just going to generate thousands of cats in quite a short time. The reproductive rate for cats is quite phenomenal. So the thing to do is to organize, trap, neuter, and release back to the area they came from, preferably, or into some safe space where they're not going to be a nuisance for people. That's what triggers the random collections, it seems, is when somebody complains. Then people have to take action, the authorities have to step in, and the outcomes there, I think, are less good than if people just look after a small colony by feeding. And there are people doing this tremendously well, organizing volunteers to just put a little bit of food out and maybe catch cats now and again, take them to vets for neutering. That gives you the best control. And it's amazing how healthy those pets can be on the street. If they can throw in a vaccination for those cats when they're done as well, it helps even more. But there are cost constraints, of course, with this kind of approach.
You just said perfectly well, and I was really hoping that was intentional. But this is something that I think a lot of people think about, because you want to do something good. You feed an animal in the neighborhood, and it's, as you said, the colony sprouts up so quickly that it can't be contained.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
Now, kindly, Dr. Martin Wyness, founder and CEO of British Veterinary Center, has stayed with us. Dr. Martin, I want to get to some of the texts that we've had coming in on the lines. And one of them I find quite interesting. How can you treat cat flu or feline corona in the long run? How do we ensure that it doesn't spread to others in the house, whether it's many other rescues, 20 rescues who all have the same symptoms, or one of those 20 cats that actually exhibit respiratory symptoms?
Okay, well, the first thing to say is those are two very, very different diseases, so the approaches would be quite different in both, and the first thing would be to get a proper diagnosis as to what it was. Cat flu is very, very common, so people will usually recognize that quite easily. Cat coronavirus is also very, very common, but rarely causes disease, and the problems that it does cause are serious when it happens, but most cats that get corona don't get the serious problems. So it's a more complicated situation that depends very much on an accurate diagnosis. The first thing would then be to run through that diagnosis with your vet, and having decided what it is you're dealing with, you'll come up with the best policies. Cat flu is not a single disease either. It's usually one of two virus diseases, herpes or calicivirus. In practice, the treatment's going to be isolation to prevent other pig cases getting those diseases. They're spread typically by fairly close contact or contact with objects. So if you keep cats together in a small space, they're going to get it. It doesn't tend to spread through the air quite as well as things like human influenza, for example. It's very much a question of extremely good hygiene. And if you use the right kind of disinfectants, that's a topic in itself when you're dealing with animals, or small children for that matter, but the right kind of disinfectants will help eliminate the disease in the environment. And then you've got to isolate the individual so that new ones coming into your environment don't bring it in. If you've already got it in a cattery, you're not going to cure it out. It will remain in those cats possibly for life. The herpes virus in particular will remain latent, and it can recur at any time. But if animals are well fed and their immune systems are kept strong, they tend to fight off the worst of those diseases. And they may get recurring bouts, but they're usually manageable and self-limiting. If something complicated happens, like they get another problem, a stress, or maybe another virus, an immunodeficiency virus, then you can run into more complications again. So each situation's in need of assessment, and I guess the best thing would be to tailor the approach with your vet, you know, have a good discussion with your vet and work out the best approach for your particular situation.
And I want to come back to that coronavirus point, because I did know that animals had contracted coronavirus, but I didn't know how prevalent it was. I mean, how can you tell if your pet has managed to get this? And if they have, where is that usually coming from?
Well, we've seen coronavirus in many species for many years. It's no surprise to vets that there's a coronavirus running rampant through the human population. We've been dealing with this for a long, long time. It's been of most concern in cats, but it's not a disease that goes from cats to people. It's a different coronavirus. It's one that's specific for the cat. So when you say, does the cat have coronavirus? Well, he may have a cat coronavirus, or may have had one and may have immunity to that and have no problem with it, and he's not going to pass it on to anybody or any other cat. But the human coronavirus is one that spreads through humans. It doesn't really affect pets much. Now, if you really push it, if you have infection in a household and you have a cat, then it is possible for that cat and some other species too to pick up that infection. But it's usually self-limiting, and it's of no consequence in the spread of the disease. So if your pet has coronavirus, human coronavirus, COVID-19, it's because you gave it to him, and he's not an important factor in the spread of that disease back to humans, as far as we know at this stage. And there's enough data, I think, out there. We have had a lot of research going into this, and nobody has found coronavirus, COVID-19, human-type virus causing problems in humans from pets at home. It's the other way around. It's the human that's the risk for the pet.
Right. That's a very clear explanation. Thank you so much for that.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
Dr. Martin, thank you so much for hanging on the line with us. We have so many questions that have come in for you. There's one I want to get to. Somebody has said, our lovely Labrador has developed a brownie red patches on the elbow and ankle joints. He keeps licking his joints and his hair is discolored, but there's no sign of any blood or discharge. Do you have any advice there for how those pet owners should go about treating this?
Yeah, it's probably a normal phenomenon if it's just specifically elbows and hock joints, the joints in the back legs, where there's a bit of pressure when he lies down on hard ground. Heavier dogs that lie down on rougher surfaces will develop calluses in areas that contact the ground. Having said that, as always with medicine, it might not be that. You do need your vet to check it out and see. But if it is just callus formation, it's a question of giving softer bedding, making it more difficult for them to find hard bits of ground to spend long amounts of time on, and just really looking after that quite delicate skin. It'll toughen up as calluses form, and it's not of any great consequence. It's not serious. But if he's licking it, you might find the calluses have broken. He could lick it till the skin is so soft that it breaks very easily, for example. And the same as with people, if they get cracked heels, for example, it can be a nuisance, not serious, but a nuisance enough to warrant more attention. So I'd have it checked out.
Right. And Warren has been in touch with, going back to our conversation actually about vaccines, do vaccines in pets, taking dogs as a benchmark, contribute to side effects? And he's specifically calling out autism-like side effects.
Autism is quite a hard thing to diagnose in a dog, I would think. It's a condition of higher function, I think, that probably doesn't apply. But I would say the side effects are going to be the more immediate and obvious things that you see. I don't think there's any cognitive change in vaccinated versus unvaccinated pets. But side effects can happen. The most serious is anaphylactic shock, which people probably know about because you, after your COVID vaccination, are supposed to sit around for 15 or 20 minutes. And the reason for that is that the nurses want to know if you're going to fall over or not. And if you do fall over, they'll give you adrenaline and you'll get back up again. That can happen. If your dog has skin allergies, sometimes those happen after vaccination as well. You can trigger itchiness. transient, not particularly serious, but maybe a sign that you want to be careful when giving the next vaccination, because the more vaccines you give, potentially the stronger immune response you're going to provoke, and you might have a more serious episode the next time. Having said all that, vaccine reactions are quite rare. We don't see too many of them. And the benefits of giving the vaccine, the benefits of not catching the disease, far outweigh the small risks of side effects. And the side effects that do exist, provided you're aware of them, will be dealt with. So nothing dies of anaphylactic shock if there's help on hand.
Right. And I have a more simple question for you that's come in, more straightforward perhaps. Mustafa has said, what age should my cat get neutered?
4 months. How old is he now? Have you missed that time frame?
Mustafa hasn't indicated exactly how old his pet is, but that's good to know. 4 months is an appropriate time to do
four
that.
4 months, now. Yeah. Reason being, they'll reach puberty at 5 months, and you want to start you don't want, unless you want to breed more cats, which is another topic for discussion, you probably want to do your neutering before puberty is reached. So 4 months is ideal. It's not harmful to do it later. You can still do the procedure later, but you may miss out on some of the benefits. So the benefits of spaying a female cat, for example, are that she will not get breast cancer later in life if you do that soon enough. She won't get pyometra. She won't get a uterine infection later on. You won't have unwanted pregnancies. With the males, you'll have less chance of them roaming around and spraying and territory marking behavior. So there are many good reasons to do early neutering in cats. And 4 months, really 4 months is because that's when they finish their vaccine course. You know, if you've done everything by the book, the vaccines will have been finished by then. And that's really the criteria that I go by in the clinic. If pets haven't had all their vaccines, we don't really want them in the clinic. If we can help it, you know, except for emergencies. So get the vaccines done and then do the neutering as soon as you've done that.
Right. And now we have gone through a number of listener questions, but Zena has also found a couple of pet stories that have been making the rounds recently, and she was going to share some of them with us.
Yes, Dr. Martin, it was World Animal Day yesterday, so let's go through a few news animal-centric news stories this week. The first one is, this really made me sad. Nearly 24 species of birds, fish, and other wildlife set to be declared extinct and removed from the endangered species list. They include the ivory-billed woodpecker along with 22 other species of birds, fish, mussels, and other wildlife. That's according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm not sure if this is something that they do yearly, but 22 species just wiped out from the planet.
It is absolutely tragic. I mean, it is so depressing to just listen to these news stories all the time coming out, the damage that we're doing. And the solutions are so complicated, it seems. We don't seem to be able to get a handle on just looking after the planet that we've got, which is the only one we have. So what can I say? You know, the same as everybody else is saying at the moment is that we need our politicians to really get together and do something sensible for once in a coherent fashion to get the job done, to try to look after what we have. It will recover. If we can do the right things, we can recover environments and ecosystems. But really, we're taking it to the line because there's a point where we won't be able to make that recovery. And, you know, and the science is supporting the idea that we need to make pretty drastic changes pretty quickly if we're going to have any kind of impact. So I'll add my voice to that, but it's not a message that is unknown. It's nothing new in what I'm saying there.
Yeah, I just find it incredibly sad because, you know, my kids are 6 and 3 and I want us to travel around the world and show them all these animals in certain parts of the world. But it's tragic that they won't be able to see these species anymore. There's another, I think we've got one more story. A new survey conducted in the U.S. says the average American spends $1,163 a year on their pets. That's $4,200. Do you think the UAE's pet owners tend to spend higher or lower than this amount, $4,200? I wouldn't even spend that on my kids.
It's hard to say, isn't it? Averages are very misleading, but certainly people are willing to spend money on their pets, and it's not just on vet fees. It's toys and bedding and food and all sorts of stuff. So I guess when you add it all up, pets are a luxury item in many ways. You know, there is a cost involved. I'm not saying you have to spend that amount to have one, but there will be a certain expenditure, even if it's just food, involved, and people need to know that before they start. Did I hear, Sonal, you don't have a pet? Does this mean that you're open for adoption? Because I think we should just send the adoption agencies your way.
I don't currently have a pet, though. It's funny, I was actually thinking about this story. We do have a stray cat that's kind of adopted us. So we do take care of that, our cat's sort of vet bills and feed the cat. And he kind of comes and goes as he pleases. But I was thinking that $4,200, we spun well over that on a pet that isn't even a house cat for us, or isn't even a house pet. So no, it is definitely an expensive thing to have a pet here in the UAE.
I alluded to what one of my cats was doing, Bandit. He's the biggest cat of our lot. And I was looking at what he was eating, and he consumes these sachets of premium cat food. And you just don't want to add it up. So I had to be the sort of tyrannical father kind of person and say, look, this is ridiculous how much one cat, because he eats half of it and then he walks away. And this is the infuriating thing with some cats. I think we tend to spoil them a little bit too much. That's typical cat behavior for you, though. You do need to think it out. You don't need to spend millions, but there's a certain amount that's going to be needed for any pet. So think about it before you get one. And if you've adopted one from the street, well, fantastic. I would just make sure that he's neutered. So no, that would be the next thing. If you haven't done that, you might want to think about that.
I've learned a few basic things today, when to neuter and about basic vaccinations. I think I'm all set. So we will talk to you about those adoptions. But yeah, maybe sometime in the future when I have a little more time to be at home to spend with the pet. We'll see. We'll be in touch about that. But for now, thank you so much, Dr. Martin Wyness, for spending the time to answer some of our listener questions. I know everybody very much appreciates that.
My pleasure.
Take care. I've learned so much today, Z.
Yes, and as Dr. Martin said, he's going to send over those adoption papers.
Before you know it, I could have a pet pretty soon.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live your best life on Dubai i103.8.
Live from Expo 2020 Dubai.
Good afternoon. It's Sonal Rupani standing in for Helen Farmer today. She is climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, so we look forward to seeing her on her return next week. Today, though, we're live from Expo 2020 Dubai. It's our very first show down here. We're in the Mobility District, so do come say hi if you're nearby. This hour, we're talking about all things addiction. Now, this is something that I think a lot of people will think about for family members, about how to get help, or even if you yourself find that this is something that you struggle with in terms of just getting hooked on things and getting really deep in, feeling like you don't have the level of self-control to manage that. Now, we are going to come to that very soon. In fact, we do have an expert on the line with us at the moment. It's Dr. Yanis Dilipalas. He is a psychiatrist and the medical director at Thrive Wellbeing Center. Dr. Yanis, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Yes, and we're really interested in talking about this subject of addiction. Can you start by talking through why some people seem to be more susceptible to addiction than others?
Yes, let's start. First of all, what do we mean by addiction? Addiction is nothing more than a severe substance use disorder. So addiction is happening actually when an use of a disorder is uncontrolled. So it can lead to the person desiring to have more and more of the substance, leading to physical health problems, mental health problems, and of course patient family issues. So some people, in fact, they are more prone to being addicted. This is what we can call addictive personality. This is a term that we have been using lately, describing people that they are a little bit into taking risky or showing risky behaviors. They are the people that they want some kind of an adrenaline kick. And substances, it can be a solution for them. And of course,
And what's behind that in terms of why some people have a more addictive personality? I mean, specifically, I guess, neurologically, do they have something different going on in the brain, essentially?
Yes, there are some studies showing that, for example, they can have high dopamine levels in some specific regions of the brain, namely frontal and prefrontal cortex, and because of the high availability of dopamine, it is hard to regulate it. So they need the external kicks, the constant desires for more and more risk-taking behaviors. Of course, we cannot neglect the fact that there can be also comorbidities behind an addictive personality. For example, it can be neurodevelopmental challenges, such as ADHD. We know for sure that ADHD is a neurodevelopmental condition where there are abnormalities in neurotransmitters like dopamine. So it's not only about the higher levels of dopamine, it can be also the dysregulation of the neurotransmitter in the brain, seeking these persons to seek and have the desire for this kind of stimulation. And as well, we can have underlying psychiatric conditions, for example, depression or anxiety, and the individual wants to regulate emotions or self-medicate with substances. This can also lead to addiction.
Right. And when you talk about some of those different issues from, you know, psychiatric issues to hormonal issues as well, is this something that could be hereditary? If people see that they have parents, for example, or grandparents who have an addictive personality, is this something that might raise alarm bells for people?
Yes. And this is for sure the case because there are many, many, many identified reasons behind addiction. We have, for example, developmental factors. For example, having parents that they used to abuse, it sends the wrong signals. It's an accepted behavior. There are genes also involved. There are genetic reasons behind addiction. We know for sure that genes are involved in addiction. And if we scratch a little bit or dig into the medical history, we can find in the extended family family members that they have been addicted. So we have genetics. We have developmental factors. We have family factors. For instance, if there is an upbringing in a family with emotional deprivation or people not having the affection or the care they need from the parents, this can lead to emotional needs, which in later life can be somehow filled wrongly with substances. Right. And we have also...
Oh, no, please continue. I was just going to ask you a little bit about the treatments mm-hmm. now. When we look at different ways that you can treat people who have an addictive personality, because you're mentioning a lot of physiological issues. When I think of mm-hmm. treatment, you also think of behavioral treatment, but is this able to support some of the underlying reasons or causes for somebody having an addictive personality?
Definitely. Also, of course, we need to acknowledge that there is no one size fit for everybody, and each treatment has to be customized and personalized to the needs and also to the nature of the substance. It's a different, for example, treatment plan for someone with alcohol abuse disorder and different for cocaine or anything else. But we need to start from the point that one part of the treatment is acceptance of the individual that actually he or she has a problem. So without having the first step, there is not going to be any treatment because the risk for withdrawal of the treatment is high. So it's absolutely essential for the individual to actually accept the fact that there is a problem. And then there are many available treatments in our hands. There can be medication that they can help the acute phases of the withdrawal and make the cravings be less intense, which is also the major reason why somebody relapses in addiction. There is a craving for the substance, so I get rid of my psychologist, I get rid of my psychiatrist, and I go and I crave for the substance. It can be also support treatment, support groups. We know for decades that AAs and NAs, Anonymous Alcoholics and Narcomans Anonymous, have also provided an extensive support to these individuals. It can be, of course, another important parameter is to identify any underlying psychiatric or psychological issues that may reinforce the need for addiction. For example, if there is anxiety or depression, we need definitely to manage that. I will give you just a simple example. There are a lot of people with depression without knowing that they have depression or without willing to address it with a mental health professional. And they choose the solution of the self-medication with alcohol, which is actually a depressant. It causes more depression. So you can see we have a vicious cycle. So if this person treated for the alcohol abuse without addressing depression, it is pointless. So every treatment needs to be customized without leaving aside other important comorbidities. And of course, support from the family, support from the mental health community, making the treatment as available as possible, nearby and ready to be assessed, and also making the treatment prolonged as needed by motivating the individual to stay on treatment. It's extremely crucial when we treat addictions to make not make any judgment that this is done. The addiction is done, you can continue. Because for some people, this can be a lifelong struggle.
Yes, that is definitely something that we hear about. What doesn't kill you
makes you stronger. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're joined by Sonal, actually, taking you through to 5 o'clock today as Helen is tackling Mount Kilimanjaro. I'm with you through the rest of the week. And today we're talking about addiction with our expert, Dr. Yiannis Dilipalas.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, Dr. Yiannis is a psychiatrist at the medical and medical director at the Thrive Wellbeing Center. Dr. Yiannis, thank you so much for hanging on with us for just a bit.
Thank you.
And Dr. Yiannis, we were talking a little bit about kind of the basics of addiction, addictive personality disorder, some of the ways that is a consequence of your physiological background, a psychological background as well. But when it comes to actually getting help for this, we've got a message that's come in, no name on this, so it's anonymous, but asking specifically about a family member. This person is saying, I have a family member, I think they have an alcohol issue, but how can I address this with them? I don't think they're aware of the problem.
Yes, and this is an important question. How we reach out even to family members and partners and people that we care about, because the first thing that probably is going to happen is a great deal of denial. A person with addiction does not want to accept the fact. So if one goes in, and sometimes we can be extremely, extremely concerned, and we can go a little bit on a harsh way to try to wake up the other person if you'd like. But this is the wrong approach. We need to be extremely gentle, but also showing the concern and also noticing with facts that there we know or we suspect that you have a problem, and we would like you to get some help before the problem gets bigger. So by this approach, and eventually with a lot of motivational work, it's not like a one-time thing, a person with alcohol abuse disorder will accept after the first chat to go and see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. It needs to be an motivational work and a little bit of persistence, but in a gentle way, so that denial will not come along. Because denial will lead to extremely distant. And again, not addressing the problem, not addressing the concerns that the family members have to misplace it. Oh, it's okay. I go out. It's about meeting my friends. It's not about drinking too much alcohol. So there is nothing to be worried about. And the car accident didn't happen because I drank. Somebody cut me off. So a lot of these excuses can come along. So a gentle approach, persistent, and also showing a true care of concern.
And now, assuming that you're able to get that person and convince them to receive treatment, from that point on, what can you do, again, as a family member, as a close friend, to help support somebody through the process? What is your role in that?
My role actually is to provide a lot of psychoeducation. There is a lot of misconceptions when it comes to alcohol use disorders. Where did it derive from? How can I be helpful as a family member? Should I hide alcohol? Should I be open? Should I be discreet? And the most important is that there is a lot also of guilt involved in family members, that maybe it was the neglect that led to the other family member to start abusing alcohol, for instance. So it is also very important to somehow unburden the extra suffering and guilt that is brought up into family members about one other family member's addiction. It's important also to provide psychoeducation when it comes to the actual support and how this would take place. Again, I have to go back to the fact that for many individuals, especially with addictive personality, or if they have unidentified psychological or psychiatric problems, it can be a life struggle. It can be an easy temptation. Okay, I am worried. I have anxiety. I have tried medication before, but my anxiety cannot be addressed. So I will drink because it's the only thing that works. So it can be a life struggle to refrain from alcohol. The role of the family is to support continuously. So it is a dynamic process. And the role of a psychiatrist or a mental health professional in general is to provide the support, to take away the misconceptions, and to also be the one implementing the treatment plan and make sure that this is absolutely not derailed from it. And of course, if for some reason the treatment plan is not proceeding, then we need also to think about revising, editing the treatment plan. What is the thing that doesn't work? Why that person still drinks alcohol? How can we make things better? So the family has an important role.
Dr. Yannis, one last quick one for you. We don't have too much time, but I did want to address this because it is a sensitivity people seem to feel here in the UAE. We've seen that in recent years, Dubai police have said you won't get into trouble if you come forward and seek treatment. And yet I think a lot of people who live here and feel that sensitivity feel that perhaps if they come forward for treatment, that they could get in trouble. What have you seen around this being here in the UAE?
I feel that... Now, a lot of treatment programs are available in government hospitals in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi. And of course, the government works extremely, extremely actively into bringing down the stigma and taboo about alcohol use disorder. At the same point, and regardless, we need to say, I need to point out one thing. Addiction does not make any preferences. So it can hit people from all ages, backgrounds, ethnicities. So it is not a matter of expats or a matter of any other person in UAE. What I have seen so far is that there is a tendency for people, regardless of their background, to undermine the severity of their substance abuse. Particularly, let's talk about alcohol, which is the most common substance disorder in psychiatry. They have the tendency to undermine their alcohol problems. They definitely do not want to address it. It has to do also with the Dubai culture. People are out more, they drink more, alcohol is available, but at some point it is a constant work, and that's what we've been doing at Thrive as well, because we have a lot of information available and we are active into addressing these kind of sensitive questions, that it's okay to admit that there is a problem. And
of
help
course.
Is available.
And thank you so much, Dr. Yannis, for your information,
your
welcome. Expertise. I'm sure it will have helped a lot of people out there who are looking for help. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
That is the voice there of Dr. Yannis Delipalas. He is a psychiatrist and medical director of Thrive Wellbeing Centre.
This is Dubai Eye 103.8, live from Expo 2020 Dubai.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
You're actually listening to Sonal with Zina today. That says Helen is on her leave currently, but she'll be back with us again next week. Now, we have been talking addiction. I want to get back to this.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We have heard from a psychiatrist, a professional expert on how to manage some of these situations when it comes to addictive personalities, how you can recognize them, what some of the treatment options are. But we also caught up with Anirudh Surya. Now, he is somebody who has recovered from drug and alcohol addiction and gives a really human sort of perspective to this issue. He's somebody that you can follow if you're interested in him at Surya_Anirudh on Instagram. He also has a website you can find that's called Recovery and I. He's actually turned this around and channeled all of his energy, he says, into fitness and also into helping people recover from their own addiction issues. Now, let's start with him to learn, first of all, how he realized he had a problem and when this all started for him. In just a moment, we're going to get there. this is Anirudh Surya talking about how he became addicted.
See, as long as I can remember now, when I was a child, there wasn't much that I ever really wanted to do, you know? It was just, there wasn't any motivation for anything. There was a lot of boredom and... I noticed that I was filling that void with other things, like a lot of television. I can see now that there was a lot of running away from what I was feeling internally, and most of it was just a sheer boredom. So what probably could have been, well, definitely was a predisposed condition, genetic, I would say. There's a chemical in the brain called dopamine. And most people that do get addicted to substance are deficient in dopamine. So that's the reward chemical in the brain. So when you go off and do something and you achieve it, like, you know, say you study for a test and you get the result that you wanted, then you get a dopamine release. If you're good at sport, you won something, that's a dopamine release. Or anything you achieve, that releases dopamine in the brain. That's a reward. So that's where the predisposed condition comes from. The trigger for me was, I would say, I think about 15 at that time, and I was seeing a girl in school, and she was seeing someone else. No, it's not her fault. I was off in boarding school. So when I came back, I realized that, you know, so I felt cheated. Then, yeah, things just started getting sour from there because she was always around. I was back in the same school. So, yeah, I started drinking then. My dad used to have a bar at home, and I did not hold back.
What was the point you realized that this was a real problem for you, that you were actually addicted?
To be honest, I knew from the day I started drinking when I was 15 that this was going to be a problem. Because I wasn't drinking socially. I wasn't drinking with friends as most people start off. I started off drinking by myself, and it was very clearly a self-medication, so as they say. And I knew it then that this was going to be a problem. Obviously, it was very subconscious at that time. I suppose it got really bad right about the time I had to go to rehab in 2018, because I was abusing opioids at the time and other pharmaceutical drugs, which, you know, they are physically addictive, not just psychologically. And I started getting withdrawals, physical withdrawals, terrible withdrawals. For most of the first half of 2018, I was just managing symptoms. I wasn't able to do anything else.
So you mentioned there that you started drinking when you were 15 years old, that you went to rehab around 2018. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many years did this go on for you, for one, to start with? But also, I think a lot of times when you think about addiction issues when it comes to substance abuse, there's always certain low points. Could you describe what was one of the real low points for you where you realized you needed to get help?
Low points, there were several low points, but it's just that the denial was so strong that I thought, No, this wasn't because of drugs. This is just because of one low point was I was training to be a pilot. I couldn't do that anymore. I had to leave Australia, which is where I had planned to stay and continue my education. My mum and my sister, they had to shift house because I got into trouble with some wrong people. I had to leave the country. Like I said, my mum and my sister had to shift from where they were living, which is our house, and till this date, we can't go back to our house in Sydney.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai I 103.8.
You're listening to Sonal today, covering in for Helen as she enjoys some time off. And we're going to get back to our conversation about addiction. We've been in conversation with Ani Surya.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, he's been telling us about how he's been grappling with addiction issues, substance abuse specifically, for years of his life until finally he decided to go to rehab. And he went to a rehab facility as an inpatient where he actually learned skills to manage addiction. He says, you learn about how much it's a disease and you learn to keep an eye on your thoughts, where they're coming from and where they're going to take you, to monitor everything. And I asked him a little bit about the in and out nature of rehab, the relapsing. And he says he did try it initially in 2015 for a few weeks and relapse in a month. But when he went back in 2018, he stayed for a very long time and he hasn't had a single relapse since then. Still though, going into the world with all of its temptations, you're not in that structured environment anymore that's meant to keep you on a certain path. How did he manage to stay clean?
That's okay. Rehab is your treatment, yeah? But rehab is not the long-term solution. A lot of people think, oh, we've got a rehab, or, you know, or like we'll send a loved one who is addicted to rehab and they'll get better. Doesn't work like that. I know so many people who have been going to rehab, like coming, going for years, and that's their life, literally. Like, for good 10 years, I know some people who have spent at least 70% of their 10 years in rehab, because they go out, relapse, come back in. It's just that they're not able to, or their denial is still somewhere very strong, of the acceptance that I cannot get intoxicated. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't hit home for certain people. And unfortunately, they have to go through all of this. I was like that, honestly. I stayed for a good year and a half, almost year and a half, rehab, 1 year dedicated without going anywhere, and then half a year coming and going. I still wanted to drink. I still wanted to use. I had made it very clear that I will drink socially after some time. My therapist was just trying to stall the whole situation. She was like, give it some time, give it a few months. You know, let your medication wean off medication first. It's not a good idea to drink with the medication and whatnot. So she was just literally stalling. But I also wanted to use. Now, what happened there was that I knew that if I use, I would have to get drug tested, because we have this thing called follow-up, where we go back to rehab every couple of weeks. You go back to rehab for a follow-up, just for prognosis, as you would say, checkup, and we get drug tested there. So if something shows up in that drug test, now, of course, no one's going to hold you against your will. But, you know, the situation would get created in such a way, like, you have your family there, you have the doctor there, you have the whole team of therapists, psychologists, sponsors. So there's this whole team standing there, and without even, you know, they're not going to force you, but you will not be able to say no, and you will be back in rehab. And this is what happens to almost everybody that relapses when they go out. So they go out, they get, they relapse, they come back in. Either it's very blatant that they got high, or when they fail a drug test and this sort of a situation is created, and then they go back to rehab. So for me, it was like after a year and a half, I was like, you know what? It was COVID. It was a lockdown and all of that situation. I was at home. I started getting back into the groove of, like, because I'm a musician, so I started getting into my singing again. I started getting into fitness, and I was thinking, it's been so long. Now my body doesn't need it, and I am also not psychologically that dependent on it. It's just me not able to release this thought from my mind that I still want to get high. I can't do this anymore. It would depress me. But then I got to a state where I was like, nah, it's done with. I think let it just be. It's been so long, but I haven't done it, and I don't feel the need for it. So why should I get back into it? And I think that was it for me, really.
And, you know, it's one thing about releasing it from your mind, but Ani said that he's specifically focused now on helping other people. I wanted to learn a little bit more about that, about why he is deciding to spend his efforts to help other people with the same issue. And it seems like this experience has given you a renewed purpose as well, because I understand that you now help people with addiction issues. Tell me about transitioning into that role and when you felt, I guess, qualified to be able to guide people in that direction.
One of the major steps of recovery is staying connected. And, you keep going back. You keep going back to, have you heard of AA or Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous?
Mm-hmm.
So we go to those meetings, and there's that whole program. So we keep going back and we keep sharing our experiences, because at the end of the day, we cannot forget that we are still addicts. Like today, I might not be using, but my personality is that of an addict. There's nothing that can change that. So one of the major steps is taking this to others who are still suffering. Because when you have 5 people or 10 people are looking at you for their recovery and kind of idealize your recovery, idealize you, you're not responsible only for yourself then. You're responsible for others. So your recovery gets stronger when you're helping people, when you keep going back,
That is one of the major tenets of the program, is keep going back. So qualification-wise, yeah, I've already been certified as a yoga teacher, and this happened in 2015, early 2015. But last year, I did this program called Y12SR. It links the yoga philosophy with the 12 steps of the AA and NA programs. And this is an actual certified program. And I went and did that. And I have been using that to help people ever since.
Ani, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's clear that you went through quite a struggle and difficult journey to get your life to a place that you're happy with. And it's nice to hear that you're currently there and you're helping people as well along the way as much as you can. So thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Glad to hear that he is on the mend and channeling his energy as well into something more productive. If you want to find out more about Ani Surya, you can find his website, Recovery and Eyes. We discussed he's actually trying to help other people through a similar issue.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It's actually Sonal Rupani in for Helen Farmer today. And of course, I've got the lovely Zina Zalamea right next to me. We're live from Expo 2020 Dubai for the very first time, and we're so excited about it. Now, before we get into our next interview, I was actually thinking a little bit about an event that's coming up. This is at the UK Pavilion on Friday. They're hosting an engineer day, which on the surface may not seem that interesting to a lot of people if you're not into engineering. But I was thinking a little bit about how we decide what we're going to do with our lives at the ripe old age of 16 or 18. I know it's different depending on which educational system you go through, but I have always thought that people at a younger age should have the opportunity, and this isn't just necessarily for those graduating to university, mm-hmm. but even those looking at career changes. It's like you have the vague idea of what something is without really knowing what it looks like in practice. And I have always thought that it would be nice if there were more opportunities for us to see what careers are actually like. Did yes. you always know that you wanted to be in broadcast, that you wanted to be a journalist?
Yes, I've always, yeah, nothing specific. Like I didn't know that I wanted to be a broadcaster, but yeah, in that sort of realm, if that makes sense. Yeah, journalism yeah. has always been my thing, but you're absolutely right. I didn't actually experience it until I interned in a newspaper and at a radio station back home. So, and it was too late. I was 21 years old when I tried it out. Luckily, I liked it. Otherwise, you know, I did have a plan B. But how
yeah,
about you?
But exactly that. It's like, let's say you're 22, you're going into the workforce for the first time. Or, you know, some people actually continue on their studies and go into really specialized fields. No word of a lie, I have a friend in the U.S. who trained as a doctor, became a pediatrician. And she said to me recently, and she's around my age, we mm-hmm. went to middle school together, so she's in her mid-30s, said, Sonal, I hate it, though. But at this point, what? I've gone so far in. And, you know, she had been somebody who just, you know, her parents wanted her to do the Indian thing of becoming yes. a doctor, an engineer, or a lawyer. I don't think a lawyer even would have been good enough. So she really had very few choices there and kind of had pursued this path and realized at a certain stage she actually really doesn't like it. And so I just think, you know, I think it's a nice opportunity to be able to dabble in different sorts of professions and career paths before you have to make that decision. And that's one of the reasons I was really excited about this interview that we did with Professor Tighe O'Donovan. He's the head of School of Engineering and Physical Sciences at Heriot Watt University, Dubai. And they're doing something pretty special. They're hosting an engineer day down at the UK Pavilion on Friday. And I asked Professor O'Donovan what we should expect from this session.
Yeah, so Engineer for a Day is a program that we've developed in Heriot Watt. And it is designed to give you know, potential or aspirational engineers some experience and insights into all the joys, the challenges, the rewards of engineering, you know, of what a career in engineering might be. So we've got a huge number of variants on this. We do chemical engineer for a day, architectural engineer for a day. And recently we've been partnering with the Red Arrows and the RAF to develop our aeronautical engineer for a day. So at Expo on the 8th, we're going to be at the UK Pavilion, and we're going to, it's going to be a bit more generic. We're just going to look at many different aspects of engineering, and we hope to give people who drop by some insights and in what it might be like to be an engineer just for the day.
And tell me a little bit more about that Red Arrows session, because you did mention that engineers and pilots will be there to share their expertise. What can people expect to learn during that session?
So we're going to focus a little bit on aerodynamics and looking at fluid flow. We're going to be looking at the design of the Red Arrow jets, and we're going to have lots of our student helpers and engineers and pilots from the RAF and the Red Arrows out there to engage with anybody who's about. But we'll be looking at, so in our wind tunnels, we'll be looking at how fluid flows over the airfoil, over the wings of aircraft, and how they maneuver and how, as they change their direction, the effects that that has on the, you know, the lift, the drag, and the overall operation of the aerodynamics and the jet itself. But we'll be applying it to many different principles. We'll be looking at Formula One style cars as well. There'll be opportunities for students to design and build their own and to race them.
I did think that I have a lot of friends that would be particularly interested in that opportunity, the F1 racing. When you say design and build and race, I mean, what exactly does that mean?
So we're going to do it at small scale. So these are little race cars. Some people might be familiar with this Formula One in schools. There's lots of formulas. There's a Formula Student that universities engage with, but then there's, you know, right up to Formula One. So there's all different formulas as you go up through. We're going to concentrate on this with Formula One in schools. So you essentially design a small, I suppose it'd be handheld size car. And you're going to be able to fold it together, kind of like origami, but you'll be able to fix the wings to give you the downforce and the lift and drag that you might want to achieve. And then we put this little gas canister in the back of it. And that gives us a propulsion. We'll explode that canister and it'll fly down the track and we're going to see which one goes fastest. So there's an element of competition in there, but we hope that people will you understand what it is that makes a difference. And this is what engineers do. They try to understand the theory behind how things work and then adapt that to their advantage to then eventually race it and hopefully achieve their best design.
That sounds like so much fun that I'm sure you're going to have people clamoring to get involved with that. Is there some sort of way to apply for it? How are you going to manage the demand for that? How can people get involved?
So it is possible to sign up in advance, but we're also welcoming people just to drop in at the UK Pavilion from about 12 midday until 4 p.m. when the Red Arrows take to the sky, and at which stage we'll be encouraging people to maybe make their way to Jubilee Park where the best vantage point is. But for those who do sign up, we will be and engage with all the different activities that we have there. We're very pleased to offer and provide a certificate of participation to everybody. So they can go home and with their designs and with that kind of achievement that they've managed to do at the event itself.
Brilliant. Tyke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
So that was the voice there of Professor Tyke O'Donovan. He's the head of School of Engineering and Physical Sciences at Heriot Watt University in Dubai. And as he mentioned there, you can definitely go participate in their Engineer for a Day at the UK Pavilion this Friday. He also mentioned the Red Arrows are going to be taking to the skies. Now, if you are into this aerobatics types of displays, this is something you definitely don't want to miss this Friday.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8,
your official radio broadcaster of Expo 2020 Dubai.
Helen Farmer is actually climbing a mountain, as most of you know, so you'll have to do with me for now, Sonal Rupani, through the end of this week in for Helen. We are live from Expo 2020 Dubai today. It's been very exciting. In fact, we've been catching up specifically about an event that's taking place on Friday at the UK Pavilion. Now, we spoke already to Heriot Watt University and their Engineer for a Day program that is coming up, but also managed to catch up with Tom Bold. He's a team leader for the Red Arrows. Now, if you're not familiar, because I wasn't before today, either. It's the Royal Air Force aerobatic team, and they will be putting on a display on Friday. I asked him how one gets selected to be part of such an exclusive team.
So we look for volunteers, and in order to be that volunteer, you've got quite a few prerequisites that you need to have achieved before you can even apply to join the team. So you have to be a frontline Royal Air Force fast jet pilot. You need to have got 1,500 flying hours. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but in fast jet terms, when you're potentially only doing an hour and a half on each trip, it actually takes guys about 10 years worth of flying fast jets to get that experience. And then we ask the volunteers. Through that volunteer process, we sit down, we look at all their reports, we go through it very subjectively to pick the right people. We'll shortlist them, we'll take them out for interviews, flying tests, where we look at it a little bit more objectively, and then they join the team. But that is only then the initial hurdle, because then we have to train them, build them up in order to be able to put on the display that you witness.
And let's talk a little bit about that training, because I understand you're a qualified flying instructor. Now, especially for somebody who's coming new into the team, when I think about that kind of coordinated movement at that level of speed in the air, it makes me dizzy. How do you work up to getting that level of precision from the people that you're training?
Yeah, we take it very much a building block approach. So I will start. So we've got two new team members that will start training with us very shortly for the next year, so for the 2022 season. And I will just fly with them. So they will be right next to me, one on the right, one on the left. And those are the easiest positions to be in the team. And I will just fly loops and rolls with them constantly. They will be a little bit further away. And then as soon as they get comfortable with that, I will move a little bit closer. And then as soon as they're comfortable and I know that they will stay in, we call it a little box of airspace, but that little bit next to me, I know they will stay in the right place. When that happens, I will then bolt the next two people either side of them, which will be second year pilots, more experienced pilots. They will go outside and then we'll start looping and rolling with them all the time. Now I will start higher and I'll start bringing it closer and lower down to the ground. And then we just build everything up to there until we get to the whole nine together. And that is the same in, so the display has sort of two distinct parts. The first half where we're all together as a nine, we're putting the big shapes together and it's more graceful. Then in the second half, we split down into individual sections and it's a lot more dynamic, the second half, which is where we have the synchro pair who will pass each other at closing speeds of 800, 900 miles an hour by about 100 feet, 100 feet above the ground. But they don't instantly go into that. They start higher, further apart, and then they work it all up until we can then put the whole thing together. But that takes about 4 or 5 months worth of training to take a new team pilot and then put the whole display together.
Wow. That's actually, to be fair, that's less than I would have thought, because something like this has got to require so much trust with all of the members of the team. I imagine there's no margin for error at all. I mean, just to give me a sense of it, what would the impact be of something being, let's say, a second late?
There are kind of two aspects to this. So everything we do is, it is sort of split second timing. But we build that up and we build the trust. And in order to gain that trust, we have to have a huge amount of humility on the team. So every time we go flying, we will debrief it, but we will watch exactly what we've done on a big zoomed in high definition recording of the whole thing. And then it's the learning and the emphasis on individual training is with that individual. So they will watch their performance and they will be hypercritical, but they'll look at it and they will firstly try and identify that something went wrong. And then why did it go wrong and how can I make it better? And I'm very much looking for the individual to do that themselves. If they can't, or they can't quite see it, well, that's my role. I will then come in and mentor them and go, well, actually, I think you need to do this a little bit or change this input. But we will do that. And we do that 3 times a day, 5 days a week, all through the winter period. And that is where that trust is then built up throughout the whole team. So that every time that I loop and roll, and the guys are doing it on my voice commands rather than what they can see. So the red arrows, there are 9 of us when we're together. They're all flying on visual reference points on my aircraft. And the trick is that they are completely ignoring the other people that are around them. And the other people around them are closest shapes. They are 6 feet apart from each other. But they're completely ignoring what's going on there. And every time I just want to move the formation to the left, I will just put a simple command in, which is coming left now. I will say it with the same metronomic cadence every time. And then when I say the N of now is when that input goes in on my stick and everyone else around me moves at exactly the same time, ignoring the movement that's going in and around them. They'll just trust that they're going to put that input in at the right time. And that's how we build it up. But it takes a long time in order to build that level of trust in order to have the team work together.
Wow. And do you remember your very first time flying as part of the team? What did that feel like?
Yeah, I felt like a bit of a fraud, to be honest. I do remember it vividly, getting into a red aircraft for the first time and looping and rolling and landing from it. And it's interesting because you just think, how on earth am I going to get it? How am I going to, from that first performance that I put in, how am I then going to be a red arrow? How am I going to crack it? But you do, the learning curve is steep and you soon get very much carried away and into it. So yeah, I remember it vividly, being a little bit apprehensive of how on earth I was going to do it, but I got there.
And could you describe perhaps a slightly more complicated maneuver to me, just to give people an understanding or a picture for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the Red Arrows?
Yeah, so actually one of the more complex maneuvers that we fly, and this is going to be quite a tricky one to explain. So we have the two sections when we split. So we'll have a five and a four. The four in the second half are the more experienced pilots. They're the second, the third years. So they've done the simpler stuff. Now they're doing the real dynamic part. And there's a part now which we call the mirror roll. And it's called mirror because we have red 6, 7, 8, and 9. And red 6 and 7, who are the synchro pair, 6 is upside down. So he will roll his aircraft upside down. And then everyone else is the right way up. And he flies a bow roll. But he's upside down, so he flies an inverted barrel roll. And that is incredibly, incredibly tricky to do. And again, you only get there by, he will practice all of that on his own, and then he will get all the other people in there. But then being able to fly formation when you're upside down is different from flying the right way up. So if you're the right way up and you want your aircraft to go right, you move your stick to the right. If you're upside down, though, and you want your aircraft to move to the right, then you've got to move the stick to the left. So not only do we fly formation, we can fly formation upside down and then everything's reversed. So that just makes it a little bit more complicated as well.
Incredible. I'm sure there's so many people out there listening who are going to be eager to come watch you guys fly. Where is this going to happen, or when is this going to happen at Expo?
Yeah, so I believe it's 4 o'clock on the 8th at the Expo.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks there to Tom Bold. He is a team leader for the Red Arrows, and it's definitely very exciting to hear a little bit more about that and to learn about it as well.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.